have to sit home all day and do absolutely nothing. And but indeed, we are in the second week, even though it's 3 weeks in because of our snow day. We're in the second week of our sermon series that we're calling Seven. We're looking at the seven deadly sins. Now, the important thing to know about the seven deadly sins, if you missed the first week, is that the seven deadly sins are not necessarily seven specific sins or seven specific things that we're not supposed to do. After all, we know that sin is equal in the eyes of God. There's no such thing as one sin that's more severe or more significant than another. But rather, these are seven attitudes that the forefathers of our church have identified that can lead to sin. That we might start out on the right foot, but because of these attitudes, because of these ideologies, we go a little too far and we eventually sin. So in the first week, we talked about gluttony and greed. And remember that we said that insatiableness is the broken attitude there. The idea that we can't be satisfied, that it's never going to be enough. And so we don't appreciate what others have done for us. And more importantly, we don't appreciate what God has done for us. Greed and gluttony are all about trying to gain more and more and more. It's not about a fixed amount. There's no level at which you're no longer greedy. Being greedy is about wanting more than you already have. It doesn't matter at all how much you already have. This morning, we're looking at the next two down the list. We're looking at, well, it's not quite in order there because I wanted to be creative with the word seven, but we're looking at sloth and wrath. Now, these words, we could be really interesting and translate them really simply into anger and laziness, and we'd be almost right. The reality is sloth and wrath go a little bit deeper than simply being lazy or being mad. I want to start with sloth. Most of us, when we hear the word sloth, we think of the big, fuzzy, cuddly animal that Steve Irwin likes to bring on late-night talk shows when he was alive and now his son does. Or we might think about the movie Ice Age and the sloth character, or actually reminded me about Zootopia, which if you've seen it, if you've got kids and you've seen it with them, when they go to the DMV is run by sloths. And that makes a lot of sense to anybody who's ever had to go to the DMV. Sloths are this incredibly slow-moving animal. And I was curious when I was writing the sermon, I was wondering why that actually might be. Surely there's a reason, right? Well, turns out there is. Most animals figure out a way in the rainforest to burrow or hide from the predators. Sloths are too big for that. What they've figured out is that if they move really, really slowly, the predators won't ever see them. And so they have developed this ability to move at a snail's pace so that predators don't see them. And so because they move so slowly, they don't have to eat very much at all. So they get to stay in one tiny little safe area, never venturing very far, never moving very fast, and not eating very much, which sounds like a great life to a lot of us, I think, but sloth is meaning more than just moving slow. It means more than just not doing a lot. After all, the sloth is doing everything he needs to do, right? He just doesn't need to do a lot. Sloth goes kind of beyond that. Sloth actually is a translation of a Latin word. The original Latin word when these eight ideas that we condensed to seven started to come around was acedia. And acedia is sometimes translated into melancholy, but we don't really use that word in the same way that it used to be used anymore. Another way to translate acedia is self-centered. So in other words, sloth is less about being lazy per se, and it's more about not pulling your own weight. Those really are two different things, right? I mean, because lazy can be a temporary thing, right? We can have a lazy afternoon now and then, and I don't think God is really going to be too upset with us about that. In fact, one of our commandments, one of the 10 things that God says, these are the most important things you need to do, one of them is rest, right? We're designed to require rest. In fact, every study that's been done on productivity has found that if you give people a couple of days off, if you don't work them too hard, they'll get more done in the week than if you work them more and more and more. We just aren't designed to go nonstop. We need rest. So sloth isn't about resting. Sloth isn't about taking care of yourself. Sloth is about not pulling your own weight. It's about allowing others to do for you what you are capable of doing yourself. It's about allowing others to carry the burdens that you yourself ought to be carrying. One way I read a theologian defining sloth was like when you have five or six or seven people moving a couch or moving a piece of furniture, and one person is just kind of pretending. They're given the appearance of work, but they're not actually doing anything. They're not actually lifting. That's sloth, when you let other people carry the burden instead of you. Now, this is huge because it's really not about you, is it? It's not about how much work you put out. It's not about how much money you make. It's not about how good you are at your job. It's not about how many hours you spend in a week. It's not about how much time you spend cleaning the house or scrubbing the floors. It's about how much other people in your life have to pick up the slack. And this is kind of tough because there are times in our life where that becomes very necessary. I mean, I think all of us have had moments in our lives where we wouldn't have made it if other people in our lives hadn't picked up the slack. But that self-centeredness is when, this is where it gets a little even more complicated, a little more difficult. This, by the way, is the hardest of all seven to define. It even goes beyond just letting others help us, because that's not the message. So the message isn't about putting in tons and tons of hours. The message isn't about letting other people help us. It's still about self-centeredness. So what does that mean? Well, another way to look at it might be self-awareness. Recognizing when others have helped us, recognizing when others have done good work for us. The opposite of self-awareness is entitledness, right? The feeling that we are owed or deserve those things which we don't deserve. Now, I have to say, as a linguistic, pedantic person, I really hate what the word entitled has come to mean, because we're using it incorrectly. I mean, you can be entitled to things. If you've worked your whole life, and you've earned a pension, and you get that check every month, you're entitled to that. You earned it. You work all week, you do everything your boss tells you to do, that paycheck at the end, that's not a gift. You're entitled to that. You earned it. So yeah, we can be entitled to things, but what we tend to mean when we say entitled is the feeling of being entitled to things that you have not earned, the feeling of being entitled to things that you don't deserve. And that kind of is what sloth really is about. It's not really about any one thing that we do or do not do. It's about that kind of attitude of entitledness, that attitude of feeling that we are owed or deserve things. And this can go both ways, by the way. This can mean that we feel like we're owed things we didn't work for. It can also mean that we feel like other people owe us things that we haven't paid for, whatever paid for might mean in that context. So sloth has a lot of layers. It's more than just being lazy. That's like 90% of it. But really, it's about not being aware of the work that others are doing around you and not being willing to pull your own weight wherever it is you're able. Paul tells us in Ephesians 4 that the purpose of this is that there are those in our midst, including us at times, who aren't able to pull their own weight, who aren't able to do as much as they'd like to do. And if we who are able, we who have enough, we who have the resources, the time, the strength, the ability, the health, if we're not doing our work, if we're allowing other people to pull us up, then that's less for those who aren't able to pull themselves up. That's really kind of layered and thick and complicated, but it's worth mentioning and worth discussing. As we said in the first week, it's not that these seven things are specific sins, but they're attitudes that lead to sin. We might think about the sins that this attitude leads to. Paul identifies one in Ephesians 4, stealing. It might seem, if you just kind of glance through, that Paul's bouncing around. But when he talks about laziness and stealing, he's talking about the same thing. Isn't stealing a lazy thing to do, right? It's the feeling that you deserve or are entitled to the belongings of someone else, something that you haven't earned, something that you haven't paid for, something that you haven't worked for. So Paul rebukes, in this specific example, stealing, which is a sin. It's one of the commandments. Again, it's breaking a commandment to steal from others. And that comes from that attitude of self-centeredness. Excuse me. So I want to point us to Ephesians 4. This is once again Paul speaking to a bunch of brand spanking new Christians. The church was a brand new thing. The earliest and biggest controversy in the church, which remains a controversy in the church today, was its diversity. As you've heard me say before, in the first century and before that, if you went to some sort of a religious institution, like a synagogue, everyone there looked like you. They spoke the same language as you. They were from the same communities as you. They were part of the same race. They were part of the same creed. Often the traditions were very specific and very rigid. In fact, because there weren't a whole lot of big cities yet, and the biggest city in the world in the first century had 100,000 people in it. That's the size of Springfield, Missouri. So people were more spread out. They were living in more rural communities. So chances are everybody at your synagogue was related to you, or at least most of them were, right? You've been to enough country churches in your life, you know what that looks like, right? And this Christian church was this brand new idea where you had Greeks and you had Romans, you had Syrians, Babylonians, Egyptians, He had people from all over the world who were coming to one place. In fact, immigrants were one of the biggest draws for the early Christian church because they would come into another country to find work or to find opportunity. And when they would immigrate into that community, there was no place for them to practice their faith. And they weren't welcomed into the faith of the locals. But the Christians said, Jesus loves you. God loves you. Come be a part of us. And so they might be in Rome with a whole bunch of Syrians and Egyptians who were attending the church. It was this beautifully diverse thing, but it didn't work. I mean, in theory it did, but the people didn't get along. They fought and fought and fought. They fought over the silliest things. So much of what Paul has to address is addressing cultural differences, things that are kind of weird to read today, like when Paul gives instructions for how to cut hair. It seems weird. Why would God care about how we cut our hair? Well, the reality is, I don't think God really does. What matters in this context is Paul trying to address the cultural differences. In one example, one culture viewed short hair as scandalous and inappropriate, and another culture viewed long hair as scandalous and inappropriate. So what do you do in that situation, right? When you walk into church and half the people think what you're wearing is offensive and the other half think what you're wearing is modest. And if you changed, it would just be flipped, right? What do you do when the people are so different in the church? Well, you write the letter to the church at Ephesus. In fact, one theologian I read, David Wright is his name, writes that Ephesus is, if you were to sum it up, Christians get along. That's the message to the church at Ephesus. Get along. Stop fighting. Figure it out. And so we come to Ephesians chapter 4, and in Ephesians chapter 4, we have this kind of really cool pinnacle moment in Ephesians. Ephesians deals with a lot of things. One of the things that it deals with kind of a lot is gossiping, because that's what was happening, right? The thing is, it was diverse, but it wasn't like there was one of every person. If you had a church of 100 people, there might be 15 Jews, maybe 20 Syrians, maybe 30 Romans, maybe it was in Rome, you know, maybe 5 Babylonians, maybe 5 Egyptians, you know. And so you tend to group up with the people who are like you. It's natural. It's what we do, right? I mean, we do that all the time. There's a right way and a wrong way to do a lot of things. A lot of things can be either bad or good depending on why you're doing them. It's not bad to associate with people who have similar interests to you. Here in this church, we tend to group up by age, or we tend to group up by where we live or some of our experiences. The thing is, they weren't just kind of getting together in little groups of people who were like them. They were getting together to talk about the people in the other groups. They were getting together to gossip, to spread rumors, and to be angry. I know this is surprising to you to imagine that church ever had gossiping in it, but it's true. In the first century, it happened. And so Paul wants to address this, but he addresses it kind of really in a really cool way. He addresses it by addressing their anger. Ultimately, what was happening is one misunderstanding after another. These were largely cultural misunderstandings. It's something that's really fascinating to read about is things that are offensive in other cultures. We have this concept of vulgar language. Did you know that that's a new concept? That hasn't existed in the history of the English language up until about the 1700s? Because certain poor people actually spoke a different version of English than rich people. So if you were a wealthy and educated person, you would scold your children if they spoke like their poor friends, because they were high bred, they shouldn't speak like that. And over time, we started to associate certain words from that cheaper version of English as being immoral. We stopped saying that's impolite or that's not how people from our family speak, and we started deciding that saying those words is somehow immoral or sinful or bad. So we kind of, in the English language, kind of invented the concept of bad words. Excuse me, we have all of these cultural differences that don't always make sense to other cultures. In some cultures, the bottom of your feet is considered offensive. So I sit like this all the time, a bunch of you do too. That's really offensive in some parts of the world. Could you imagine if we had all of these different cultures, all of these different first-generation immigrants in one church? It would be a nightmare. But that was the first century. So people were fighting because they were offending each other, because they were upsetting each other, because they were sometimes rightfully, sometimes wrongfully, hurting one another. And so Paul addresses this, and this is really beautiful. He tells them this is how they're going to deal with anger. First off is the first two words, be angry. Isn't that great? I mean, Paul doesn't tell them to just get over it. Paul says be angry. But then Paul gives them instructions for how to be angry like a Christian. You ever thought about that? How does a Christian be angry? How do you be angry like a Christian? Well, this is how. First off, you be angry with the person you're angry with. You talk about it with the person you're angry with. You don't talk about it with your friends. You don't talk about it with your family. You don't talk about it with other folks in the church. You go to the person you're angry with and you address it with them. Paul rails against gossiping. He talks about it as a cancer. He says that it destroys the church. He says that if a church has gossiping, it cannot survive. So he says, be angry. It's fine. You have a right to be angry sometimes. Be angry. Address it with the person. Be angry with them. Talk to them. Be humble. Be compassionate. Accept that you actually might be the one that's wrong, that they might be angry with you for good reason. But be angry with them. And then Paul gives the advice that every one of us gives to newlyweds, right? Don't let the sun go down on your anger. Paul takes that a step further. He says, don't let the sun go down on your anger, and don't let the devil in. But what Paul's saying is, look, there are times in life where it becomes necessary to address something with someone else in a Christ-like way. It becomes necessary at times to say, listen, I know you love me, but you really hurt me. You really upset me. You really offended me. I don't like what you did. I don't think that was the right thing. But when we decide that, regardless of whether or not there's a resolution, notice this is not conditional. Paul doesn't say, if you work it out, go to bed without being angry. No, Paul says, that's the end of it. You get a day to work it out. At the end of the day, drop it. That's what Paul says. At the end of the day, let it go. At the end of the day, it's time to say, I forgive you. Even if they're still angry with you, don't let their sin become your sin. Even if they're still angry with you, even if they have not repented and you are convinced that they're wrong, even if they're still causing problems and still making you angry, address it with them and then let it go. It's easier said than done, isn't it? Forgiveness is never easy. But Paul reminds us that as Christians who have been forgiven by God, we simply don't have the right, friends, we are not entitled to holding a grudge against someone else. It's amazing how these two are linked together, sloth and wrath. If sloth is self-centeredness, if sloth is being entitled to things in which we are not entitled to have, then in a lot of ways, so is anger. We're not entitled to be angry. Society tells us we are. I mean, our culture tells us we are. Our culture tells us that it's okay, and that in fact it's ours. It's ours to be angry, but it isn't. Paul says, be angry with the person, go to the person, and then let it go before the sun goes down. Imagine if it was a practice of ours that every time we see the sunset, we think about where we're angry, and we internally let ourselves let it go. That really means let it go, and friends, it's not easy, and friends, we're not going to do it every time. I know I'm not going to. It's hard to let go of anger. It's hard because anger is ownership. See, the thing is, anger doesn't actually work. It doesn't do anything. It's a totally ineffective tool. I mean, honestly, truly think about this. In your life, when has anger ever changed a person? When has anger ever granted justice or reconciliation? When has anger ever changed the outcome of something for the better? Maybe you've got one or two stories of a fluke, but I bet that almost every time, if not every time, it didn't do any of that. It did no good whatsoever. The only thing anger did was make it worse and make you feel worse. The reason we're angry is because sometimes things happen in life that we have absolutely no control over, and if we're angry about them, then we can have some sense of control because that's our emotion, it belongs to us, and we can control it. We can't control the other person, we can't control what they've done to us or continue to do to us, but we can control the way we feel, and we choose to feel angry because it gives us a sense of justice. It gives us a sense that we're punishing the person who hurt us because we're angry with them. But in reality, friends, the only person who gets hurt in anger is the person who's angry. So be angry. Address it. Let it go. That's what Paul tells us to do. Crazily enough, this is connected to sloth because it's part of sharing our burden. It's part of pulling our own weight. It's part of doing the work that it takes to do to live this life in Christ and to be a follower of Jesus Christ. I love the way Paul addresses things really simply. I should say that there is a good chance that Ephesians was written by a student of Paul. This is one of those things where over the centuries, certain scriptures had names added to them by well-meaning people who assumed that this was Paul or assumed that this was someone else, but the oldest manuscripts don't actually have a name. This was probably Paul, but it might have been a student of Paul, but either way, these are the words of Paul, because it's someone who learned under Paul, if it wasn't Paul, writing this letter. And so, these words from Paul are these beautiful and simple ways of living the Christian faith. That's what Paul does so extraordinarily well. Paul is our chief theologian in a lot of ways. If someone came to me and said, I know nothing about Christianity, where do I start? I wouldn't send them to the Gospels. I mean, the Gospels are great, that tells the story, but if you want to understand what it means, I'd send them to Romans, especially Romans chapter 1, to the beginning of Paul explaining these stories. And then if you want to go deeper, and I hope you do, then read the Gospels. But Paul is so good at taking our faith and explaining it in ways that make sense. And this is exactly how Paul explains sloth and wrath. So then Paul goes on to talk about stealing, which again seems like he's bouncing around, but he's really not. For Paul, anger and stealing are kind of the same thing. They're both taking things that don't belong to us. Have you ever thought about anger like it's stealing? In a lot of ways, it really is. We don't own that anger. We aren't entitled to that, and we're taking it anyway because of the way it makes us feel, not because we've earned the right to be angry. None of us have done that. Rejecting anger requires immense sacrifice. Forgiveness is such a difficult thing to do. Forgiveness is easy when people ask for it. It really is in the grand scheme of things. But most of the time when God is calling us to forgive someone, God is calling us to forgive someone who's never going to ask for forgiveness. Rejecting anger takes hard work. It means picking up the slack not only for yourself, but for someone else as well. And as unjust as that may feel, remember that the alternative is to let them carry the whole burden. Given the choice between carrying the whole load ourselves or letting someone else carry the whole load ourselves, I think God would call us to do the work. Friends, life demands that we work hard. God demands that we rest well and that we don't go to bed angry, not with your spouse, not with anyone. Don't allow Satan to own so much of your soul that your anger becomes a more important possession to you than your own salvation. Let it go, even if it feels unjust. In many ways, rejecting anger is a means of pulling your own weight, of contributing as much to this world as others have contributed to you. My prayer for us this week, and what I hope you'll pray for me, is that together we could renew our commitment to pulling our own weight, whatever that might mean in our life. Friends, when it comes to the church, we're talking about a whole lot more than going to work and making a paycheck. There's a whole lot of ways that God gives us the opportunity to pull our own weight. It's kind of scary if we really think about all of the ways that God might be calling us to work that maybe perhaps we haven't been. But my prayer is that we would work hard so that to the very best of our own abilities, we contribute to this world as much as we receive. That as long as we're able, we work to make the world a better place and to give more than we take. If you remember from the first week, we talked about how each of the seven deadly sins has seven virtues, has something that is the opposite. So if the attitude of self-centeredness and the attitude of laziness are attitudes to avoid, what's the alternative? What do we fill that void with when we get rid of that out of our souls? Well, again, this is something cool because the church fathers for centuries and centuries have already answered this for us. Diligence and patience are the opposite of sloth and wrath. Diligence is self-awareness. It's recognizing what others have already done for you. It's very easy. We don't do this intentionally. None of us do this intentionally. But it's very easy to not be quite aware of what others have done for us, to not be quite aware of just how much others are picking up the slack in our life. Diligence is about looking for the opportunities to do good. Diligence is about looking for the opportunities to pick up the slack and pull our own weight. Patience, isn't that an incredible antidote for anger? In reality, anger is about speeding things up. Anger is about trying to find a solution right here, right now. Because the reality is, none of us respond in anger 6 months later. We respond in anger the day of, or maybe a couple of days. Maybe we stew on it for a week. But anger is not a patient thing. Patience, instead, allows us to recognize that God has something in store. That God has a light at the end of this tunnel. It may not make any sense to us now or ever, but there is a plan somewhere. Patience is the recognition that if we become angry, we've taken ownership of something that doesn't belong to us, it belongs to God. If we're patient instead of angry, we can step back and watch what God intends to do with a difficult situation. My prayer is that we would continue, as long as we're able, to work to make the world better and to give more than we take, to see the rejection of anger as something that, even though society says we're entitled to it, as followers of Christ, we are not permitted to own. and that we would work not to be negated, not to be ignored, lest the burden be shifted to the shoulders of others. I hope you'll pray that for me this week. I'll pray that for you this week. God's calling us to do a lot of extraordinary things. We are in a community with so much need and so much joy. There's work to be done, and there's no shortage of things to be angry about. My prayer for us this week is that we could focus on diligence and patience as antidotes to the challenges that Satan places in our lives. Anger is Satan's language. When Jesus was being tempted in the wilderness, when Satan had no other tools left, when Christ's hunger wasn't enough, when Christ's thirst wasn't enough, Satan thought the one tool he was sure could make it work was to make Jesus angry. When Job was being afflicted, Satan thought for sure the one thing that could make Job stop would be his anger. If Satan believes that the most powerful weapon he has against God is the anger of you and I, then I got to believe that that's the one thing we ought to be working very hard to reject. So friends, again, my prayer for us this week is that we would work to reject anger, to be patient, to work hard, and to be diligent. Amen.